from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, the Obama administration laid out its big plan to combat climate change and pollution. With his proposal through the EPA, President Obama is bypassing Congress and making it clear he wants the United States to act. The plan calls for a 30% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from power plants by the year 2030 and gives states a lot of flexibility in getting there. Critics are firing back, warning of spikes in energy costs and lost American jobs. This hour on Point, we'll dig into the Obama administration's new push on climate change. You can join the conversation on air or online. Is this the way to go? Do we have a choice? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The president picked it all up on Friday at his commencement speech at West Point, talking about American energy policy.
I intend to make sure America's out front in putting together a global framework to preserve our planet. You see, American influence is always stronger when we lead by example.
And now we have the proposal. Coal country politicians not happy. Senator Mike Anzi, Republican from Wyoming, told CBS Saturday he was not excited about plans to reduce carbon emissions. Wyoming supplied roughly 40% of the country's coal last year.
The administration has set out to kill coal and its 800,000 jobs. If it succeeds in death by regulation, we'll all be paying a lot more money for electricity if we can get it.
But we've got to do it. EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy said this is about more than the climate change issues.
This is not just about disappearing polar bears and melting ice caps, although I like polar bears and I know about melting ice caps. This is about protecting our health, and it is about protecting our homes.
The administration there looking to put this in terms that make it palpable to people. Health, homes, bring it right up close. Joining us first today from Washington to look at the new proposal is Amy Harder, energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Amy, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
First thing to say is it's a proposal. This is not a done deal. If everything went perfectly smoothly, when would this start to bite? When would it begin to actually go into effect?
Not until between 2 and 3 years. So between now and next summer, EPA will be finalizing the rule and getting input from states and companies and other stakeholders throughout the country, and is expected to finalize the rule in June of 2015. But EPA, in its attempt to be as flexible as possible, is allowing states up to 2 years longer to submit their implementation plans. So, and companies and states do not need to comply with the regulation until 2030. So this is a very long-term type of regulation.
Amy, this is a 30% reduction, but that's from 2005 levels. I've read that we've already, since 2005, reduced carbon emissions by maybe 13%. So it looks like we're almost halfway there. Is it really, from where we stand now, is it a 15, 16% reduction? And is that a big deal?
Right. The EPA's decision to use 2005 is interesting for a couple of points. The EPA said that they use that number because that's sort of the general year that a lot of people use when they talk about climate change progress. So that's one reason. But also, our carbon emissions in the U.S. across the economy have actually dropped, as you noted, significantly because of our shift from coal to gas and because of the sluggish economy and stagnant electricity growth. So it's by using 2005 as a baseline year, EPA can use a larger percent reduction number. So rhetorically, it makes them look like they're doing a little bit more than perhaps what is actually going to be done. When you compare it to 2012 levels, it's about 15 to 17% reduction.
We've got 550 or so coal-fired power plants in this country now. What is that likely to look like by 2030? Will half of those be gone? Will they be somehow scrubbed up, cleaned up? Will they be converted to natural gas?
Well, it is no secret that coal is definitely on the losing end of this regulation. Right now, coal provides about 39 to 40% of our electricity, which is already down about 10 percentage points over the last several years because of all the cheap and cleaner burning natural gas we now have in this country. EPA actually predicts by 2030 that coal and natural gas will about each have 30% of the electricity market share. So some of these coal plants will definitely be shut down, but they will also be shutting down, not just for this regulation, but others as well. EPA has pushed out a lot of regulations under Obama that have been particularly hard for the coal industry because it is the biggest carbon emitting and pollution polluting type of energy. And so I anticipate numerous amounts of coal plants will be shut down, but coal will still have about a 30% market share, according to EPA.
Amy, there's famously a lot of flexibility being given to states here. What does that mean? What are the options that they'll have in hand if this goes through for making these carbon emission cuts?
Yeah, flexibility is a word that the EPA loves to use under this regulation, and that is for a couple of reasons. They can't get to the reductions they want to get to without having a maximum flexible type of regulation. And on a call yesterday with reporters, EPA officials really wouldn't limit what kind of options states and companies could use. This can include more renewable energy and more energy efficiency, but also controversial things like cap and trade programs, which are actually the most flexible type of system if you ask utilities, and also even carbon taxes can be one way that states can comply with this regulation. And one other reason why they're having this maximum flexibility type of regulation is because they're handing over the actual writing of the rule and how companies can comply with this to the states, which kind of creates this buffer, a legal buffer with EPA, because at that point, the states are on the hook legally with the companies because they're the ones who are writing the plans.
What are the odds that this will now go through without setbacks from the courts or other challenges, that by in 2015 this will start to be implemented? Are people assuming that's likely to happen more or less as rolled out or otherwise?
Well, no state or company can sue EPA until the rule is final. So I certainly anticipate EPA to finalize the rule by next summer or thereabouts, in large part because this is the cornerstone of President Obama's climate change agenda, and he really has put his leadership behind this issue. So I anticipate EPA will stay on that timeline. But after that timeline is really when things could get a little bit messy. I certainly anticipate states and companies to sue. And, you know, who knows how the courts will play out. But that is a game that will take years to see the end of it. And, of course, we do have to keep in mind what Congress is up to. I don't anticipate Congress passing any type of law that could stop this regulation as long as Obama is in office or as long as a Democratic president is in the White House. They're certainly going to be trying to stop the EPA, both coal state Democrats and Republicans. And so, but I would say the courts is where people should really be watching this fight.
The battle will go on, even as the plan is rolled out. We're going to look at what the arguments may be. Amy Harder, energy reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Amy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
With us now from Washington, Danielle Bossan, Managing Director of Energy Policy at the Center for American Progress. She worked with Democratic Massachusetts Congressman, now Senator Ed Markey, on a cap-and-trade bill that passed the House in 2009 but did not make it through the Senate. She says she got a little PTSD out of that experience. Danielle, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from San Diego in California, David Victor, professor at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. His research focuses on how regulation affects energy markets, author of Global Warming Gridlock, Creating More Effective Strategies for Protecting the Planet. David Victor, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Danielle, is this a big deal?
It's certainly ambitious. I mean, this is not necessarily this is a war on carbon pollution. And carbon pollution, as we know, has great health impacts, not just climate impacts. And it's something that we're going to be seeing the results of, not just immediately, but for generations to come. So it is ambitious.
How much of a dent does it make in global carbon emissions? 30% from 2005 in U.S. How significant is that? If it all goes as imagined, as proposed, how big a deal is this in reining in climate change? The United States here acting alone?
Well, we're not acting alone. I think what fails to kind of pierce the public perception is that other nations are doing quite a bit to reduce pollution in their own countries. But the president isn't doing this for other nations. He's doing it for people of the United States. He's doing it to increase our energy efficiency, to reduce energy bills, but also to protect our health.
I mean, is it I guess my question is, I don't mean that no one else is acting, but the U.S. contribution to pulling down carbon emissions here, just considered in its own, how much of the global problem does that solve, and how much is this simply us doing our piece in an orchestra of countries, I guess President Obama would like to imagine?
I think the orchestra analogy is apt. We are reducing, this act alone should meet about a third of the president's goals for the nation. And don't forget that we're also going to be going to other nations and looking to create international solutions to climate problems. So without us doing this, it's highly unlikely that we can convince other nations to come forward and make commitments of their own.
David Victor, we just got a minute before the break, but this important on its own or important as a signal from the U.S. to the rest of the world community?
Oh, I think it's a very important signal. The rest of the world is looking to see that the United States is going to do something in this area. And so far, we've been talking a lot, but a lot of other countries have become worried about the credibility of the U.S. in these international negotiations. And this is a signal. I mean, this policy has a number of problems that I'm sure we'll talk about, but this is certainly part of a signal from the Obama administration that the United States is a credible partner, along with China and India and Europe and Japan and other countries.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Obama administration's new carbon emissions cutback plan for American power plants, 30% by 2030, and what that might mean for the climate, for the economy. David Victor joins us from University of California, San Diego today. Danielle Busan is here from the Center for American Progress. The EPA Administrator Gene McCarthy saying yesterday, here's our goal.
In 2030, when the states meet their final goals, our proposal will result in 30% less carbon pollution from the power sector across the United States in comparison to 2005 levels.
And it's not just about carbon emissions and climate change, it's about health, she emphasized.
Carbon pollution from power plants comes packaged with dangerous pollutants like particulate matter, nitrogen oxide, and sulfur dioxide, and they put our children and our families at even more risk.
Coal state representatives not happy. Here's Governor Earl Ray Tomlin of West Virginia saying yesterday the new proposal would drive straight into his state's economy.
Based on our initial review of these rules, not a single West Virginia power plant would be in compliance if the rules were in effect today, despite the billions of dollars companies have already spent to modernize their facilities.
And here's Mitch McConnell of Kentucky.
This is the single worst blow to Kentucky's economy in modern times.
Danielle Busan, help us understand here. Every state's going to be given a reduction target, we read, tailored to its energy mix. How's that decided, whether the size of a state's reduction target? How does it relate to its energy mix? What does that all mean?
Well, it's looking at what the states have already done to help reduce carbon pollution in their utility sector. So if a state has already been employing energy efficiency or has a renewable energy target, the EPA isn't going to come in and say, well, that's great that you've done this, but now meet this much higher standard. It's looking at what the state has historically and currently is producing and how it can improve the efficiencies.
So the dirtier the mix, the higher the challenge. But those are the states who are going to be at the get-go anyway, least well-positioned to respond, I guess.
At the get-go, but as Amy mentioned earlier in the show, this is where the importance of the flexibility of the rule comes in. The states have 1 to 2 years to come up with plans and then ultimately 15 years to help meet those targets.
David, what do you think is going to be the most important avenue for meeting these targets?
Well, EPA, I think, has looked at a lot of different avenues, and the way they've calculated these state-by-state goals is they've started with what's going on in the state in the year 2012, and then they've looked at potential reductions. Most of the reductions that EPA is focused on come from switching from coal to natural gas, a little bit from making coal power plants more efficient, and also a big bet on renewables, which really means wind right now. And so when you kind of take a step back from this proposal, what it envisions is a power sector that continues to eat away at coal, so such that coal is maybe about one-third of total power generation. Natural gas rises and continues to rise in importance, and then there's a huge diffusion of wind power really across the country with a lot of flexibility that Danielle is talking about, so that individual states and groups of states can set up trading systems and give the utilities some flexibility in how they actually comply with these goals.
Is it fair to say this is going to be relatively easy for some states and pretty difficult for others, or what's the range of difficulty, David?
Well, I think it's interesting that when you look at the list of states, and EPA has a list of essentially all the states and then a goal for each state, and so the existing coal states like West Virginia, those goals are set at very high emission levels because those states are incredibly dependent upon coal. And I think that was by design by EPA because they want to make sure that all states do something in this area. My guess is that the states that are already aggressively cutting emissions, like California, my state, or the states in the Northeast, they're going to find this relatively easy because their own state policies right now are going to be more important than the federal policy. States Wyoming, West Virginia, a handful of other coal-dependent states, Texas is going to be on the front lines here. Those states are going to have to do a lot, and that might be expensive for them.
Danielle, what about opposition? Where do you expect it to be most fierce, and what arguments do you expect to be most prominent? You said that working on the cap-and-trade bill that you worked on with now Senator Ed Markey was a pretty traumatic experience in some ways. Things can get fierce here. What do you expect?
Well, we've already seen opposition to this proposed rule. We saw it before the rule was even released. I think half the talking points that you played earlier were written well before this rule was unrolled by the EPA. And I expect that those attacks will continue. They'll continue with the same type of attacks that we saw when cap and trade legislation was going through Congress, namely that there's a war on coal, when really it's a war on carbon pollution and frankly, coal-fired power plants are the largest source. But the truth is that the market is killing coal. It's not just these EPA regulations. We've seen an incredible reduction in the price of natural gas, a lot of interest and funding for renewable energy. So if anything, this rule could actually help provide certainty for coal-fired power plants and allow states to say, all right, well, certain coal-fired power plants will be able to operate because we'll offset that carbon pollution with other acts within the state.
David, what about the economic consequences here? There are certain assumptions baked into the EPA outlook about natural gas prices that I guess may or may not hold. How do you read the economic cost net-net of doing this? And I guess we don't have to go to the bottom line too quickly because it may come at us in layers. Walk us through that economic future if we get on this path.
Yeah, so I think the first thing to say is we have actually no idea. I don't think actually anybody has a clue what the real costs are going to be.
That's pretty incredible in itself.
Well, this is not unusual. This happens a lot with large economy-wide regulations like this. When you lay them out, you just don't know everything you need to know, and a lot of what you need to know, like the future price of natural gas or demand for electricity, is probably basically unknowable. And so a lot of this hyperbolic commentary about the bill, pro and con, has been really based on a bunch of assumptions that may or may not hold. When I look at it, probably the single most important assumption is the price of natural gas. And I think as analysts start to really dig into this, one of the things that's a little unusual in the proposal is that EPA uses the year 2012 as the year for beginning these calculations. And 2012 was a particularly unusual year where natural gas prices for part of the year were less than $2. They're now at about $4.50, kind of bouncing around in that range. So long as natural gas prices stay low, which is really about supply of natural gas from fracking and horizontal drilling, so long as prices stay low, then the option of closing some coal plants, making others a little more efficient, and building a lot of natural gas along with renewables, that's what most states are going to do. One of my concerns about the overall analysis is that the proposal doesn't have any safety valves in it, really, so that if major assumptions like the price of natural gas, like the demand for electricity, if those assumptions turn out to be wrong, you know, either way, then the proposal doesn't become more stringent or less stringent. And I think that's going to be a real a real problem for companies, especially if it turns out, for example, that gas prices go back up. A lot of electric companies, in fact, have lived through this before. They made huge investments in natural gas power plants in the 90s on the theory that gas prices were going to be low, and the gas prices shot up, and a lot of those plants were just a financial disaster.
What would the economic implications be of that for the country or regions of the country if we did see gas spikes in the same future where these emissions cutbacks are supposed to be happening?
Well, that would drive up the total cost of complying with this. EPA did a cost-benefit analysis for this, as it has to do with all regulatory proposals, and their analysis for the costs are strikingly low, and the benefits are huge, and most of the benefits are from air pollution, not from climate change, reduced air pollution. That whole cost-benefit analysis holds so long as these assumptions about natural gas prices, about continued improvement in wind power technology and so on, so long as those hold. If less favorable assumptions or if less favorable things actually unfold in the real world, then I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a big increase in the total cost. It's still hard to see that the costs would rise so much that, at least according to EPA's analysis, they would become bigger than the benefits, because EPA has calculated huge benefits from this.
But are you talking benefits like, let's say, health benefits from avoiding asthma, from particulate emissions? They're packaging all that in here.
Exactly, including benefits from avoided climate change, because there's a way of calculating the benefit of slower global warming, of slowing global warming. And it's interesting, I think, politically, that the president, Gina McCarthy, and the EPA and their summary fact sheet about this actually emphasize these national and local health benefits much more than climate change, because I think while this is basically a war on carbon pollution and a policy that's being driven for reasons of climate change, the politics of selling climate change to the American public are really, really difficult, whereas the politics of telling people that their children are going to be healthier and that's going to be a visible benefit, those politics are much easier.
Danielle, avoiding building new seawalls and raising cities and retreating from coasts and even the cost of health care over time, those are kind of slow-motion costs. The utility bill that arrives in the mail or, you know, online is very real and immediate. How do you think this is going to go down with consumers if we see energy price spikes or, you know, just higher plateaus because of this regulation?
Well, I think one thing that's important to note is that there was a recent Washington Post and ABC poll that talked about that showed a majority of people, both Democrats and Republicans, were not only supportive of a law that reduced pollution from power plants, but actually were willing to pay higher prices. Now, I do agree that nobody likes to see a higher bill in the mail, but if you understand what it's linked to, then I think that can be tremendously helpful for the public. And I would add that getting that monthly bill, and if a higher number arrives on your monthly bill, that does cause some pain. I see it in D.C. summers when my AC comes on, my electricity bill is certainly a little bit higher. But what that doesn't even compare to the cost of what happens if there is a sea level or a seawall that tumbles down and all of a sudden my house is going to be, I'm getting bills from insurance companies and construction companies.
Yeah, though that may seem further away than the utility bill. Let me ask you about this. If natural gas is the thing that's most likely to flow in and replace this coal, that the price of that will depend on the supply, David Victor says, from fracking. Does that mean that this plan presumes it's going to be pedal to the metal on fracking across the country, like big, big new projects on fracking all over to make this work?
Well, we're talking about, as Amy mentioned earlier, about a 7% reduction in coal-based power. So I think that there's already an aggressive move to retrieve and distribute natural gas. I think that will probably continue. And as David mentioned, even if there is a pedal to the metal, the prices rise, we are going to see better benefits than costs.
What about when we frack? We've read a lot about how methane escapes into the atmosphere, but that may not be calculated. So what about the real net benefit of moving to natural gas? It's cleaner coming out of the smokestack, but what about when you include the wellhead escape of greenhouse gases?
That's absolutely something that we should be concerned about. We should be concerned about methane, not just from fracking, but from a number of other practices that we do in this country. But we also need to be concerned about climate change. We also need to be concerned about health benefits.
Isn't methane relevant to climate change?
Yes, it's actually one of our largest climate forcers.
So how do we know if our actual net gain, if we're calculating smokestack emissions, but we're not calculating wellhead emissions of methane?
Well, I think that is something that I would love to see Congress take up. I would love for the EPA to look at more carefully. And fortunately, because this is a proposed rule, there is a year for both comments to come in and for the EPA to take those considerations under account.
David Victor, what about that? Are we holding a hand over one eye here, only calculating the smokestack emissions and ignoring the other? How do you see the net benefit if we move to more natural gas, which so far at the wellhead can be kind of dirty itself?
You need to produce natural gas and plug the leaks in the system, and this is actually a completely manageable problem. There's been a whole bunch of research on this question over the last few years. EPA is starting to focus on it, including regulate it. The industry itself knows that if they don't get their act together that they're in trouble. Most recently, a huge study looking at methane leakage from fracking operations in Texas showed that with fairly simple technologies to do what are called green completions, that you can cut methane emissions by 97%. We've got to also figure out ways to plug the leaks in the natural gas transmission system. But those are all manageable problems, and we have to walk and chew gum at the same time. The U.S., like essentially all other countries, already reports its methane emissions. So in some sense, we're beginning to regulate them and disclose them, but we certainly need to do a better job on the natural gas side. But I think that's a totally manageable problem.
We're going to hear in just a moment from Robert Bryce in Texas at the Center for Energy Policy. A couple of callers first, if I may. Derek in New Orleans, Louisiana. Derek, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What's your question?
My question is, if we allow natural gas to replace coal in the marketplace, but then allow the coal companies to ship it to India and China, there's your no net gain. It's a total zero-sum game.
David, what about it?
So far the market on its own has already seen a huge rise in natural gas. U.S. electric power from natural gas in 2005 was about 19%. Now it's about 27%. So the market on its own, because of the switching, has cut total emissions from the power sector by about 15%. And what this proposal would do is basically continue pushing in that direction.
But Derek's looking around the world and asking if we're just going to continue to pull up the coal out of American soil, ship it to foreign markets. It's burned. It's in the atmosphere just the same. What about it, David?
Yeah, so the volumes of coal leaving the United States going to other markets are tiny compared to the total consumption of coal in China. The Chinese coal market overall is already twice the size of the U.S. coal market. So I think those are things to watch, but they're actually a marginal impact. Much more interesting.
Is that because of the cost of shipping coal abroad means it's just not economic?
Yeah, exactly. The cost of a ton of coal delivered in China is about $100 now, $90, and most of that is transportation, and only maybe $10 or $15 of it is the coal itself. What's going to happen in the Chinese and Indian and other large coal-consuming countries is mainly due to factors inside those countries, and that's where there's tremendously interesting news. The Chinese are adopting a whole bunch of different air pollution regulations, efficiency regulations. There are serious analysts in China who now think that the total consumption of coal in China in the next decade or so will actually peak, so stop growing, and then start to decline slowly. And they're doing that for lots of reasons, mainly local health reasons, just like the EPA is focusing on local health reasons here in the United States. But the overall impact of that on total world emissions is going to be huge. It's not going to be enough to stop global warming, but it's going to slow the increase in global warming quite substantially.
Big meetings coming up this fall in New York on this front. Do you think, Danielle, that this will put the whole world community, if we can call it that, on a more likely path toward climate change control?
Well, I certainly think that other nations are looking to see what the United States is doing. And as David mentioned earlier, we haven't been fulfilling our goals as of late. So this is a wonderful signal that we are ready to act and we need others to act with us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the Obama administration's new carbon emissions cutback plan for American power plants, 30% by 2030, and what that might mean for climate, for the economy. Daniel Bosan is with us from the Center for American Progress in Washington. David Victor is with us from UC San Diego in San Diego, California. Joining us right now from Austin, Texas, is Robert Bryce. He's senior fellow at the Center for Energy Policy and the Environment at the Manhattan Institute. Robert Bryce, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What do you see in this proposal, sir?
Well, I think, I mean, as a political matter, it's clear the Obama administration and the Democrats are trying to do bureaucratically what they could not achieve legislatively. They're imposing a de facto tax on coal or a de facto carbon tax. And I think that, you know, again, that's the political side. But if you look at the global impact, I think your other guest said we haven't been fulfilling our goals on climate change. Here's the reality. And the president said this in his State of the Union address in January. And just a few days ago, the White House released a statement on this very issue saying the U.S. is leading the world in reducing its carbon emissions. In fact, more than any other country, the U.S. has reduced its CO2 emissions. And that's largely because of natural gas in the marketplace displacing more expensive coal in many power plants. So I think that, you know, clearly this is a political effort by the Obama administration. I understand that to appeal to the green voters and the Democrats ahead of the midterm elections. But I think when you look at the bottom line here in terms of what impact this will have on global CO2 emissions and global coal demand, I think it's going to be negligible.
Negligible meaning are you assuming that, yes, there's been a decline in coal? Yes, emissions have come down since 2005 already, rather significantly in a time of economic downturn and so on.
Sure.
But are you assuming, Robert Bryce, that would continue, that we could just count on the market to bring emissions down to where we could all be comfortable with the climate effects?
Well, clearly, my bigger point here, sir, is that the global demand for coal has been soaring. Why? Because in the developing world, this is the cheapest, most abundant, most reliable source of energy for producing electricity. And electricity is the difference. That's the key commodity and the differentiator between the developed world and the poor. Since 1973, coal demand has grown faster than any other energy source. The U.S. can reduce its CO2 emissions because it can rely on natural gas. The rest of the world doesn't have that luxury, and they're turning to coal. So when I say the overall global impact is going to be negligible, I think that that's true. You look at this reduction that the EPA wants, 30% from 2005 levels, it's a reduction of roughly 720 million tons. In 2011 alone, according to the BP Statistical Review, global CO2 emissions rose by 723 million tons. So in 1 year, global CO2 emissions rose as much as the Obama administration is seeking a reduction over 16 years.
I'll look for a counter to that perspective, but help us understand yours a little further, Robert Bryce. What would you say then? Should we just keep on keeping on and whatever happens, happens? Or do we need to take deliberate action to rein in and hope that other countries will then rein in as well? David Victor and Daniel Bosan say that they're beginning to. They are more than beginning to.
There's no question. And China is making some efforts in that regard. But the reality is that the U.S. doesn't have control over the rest of the world. It's called global warming. It's not U.S. warming or Texas warming or New York warming.
But does that mean we shouldn't act? What about the idea that if we act, others are encouraged to act, we become part of a concerted effort to get a handle on this?
And that's a fair point. But my counter to that is the rest of the world doesn't have our shale gas resources. What I'm saying is the U.S. should be helping the rest of the world develop better nuclear technology, because I'm adamantly pro-nuclear. I'm adamantly pro-natural gas. But when you look at this on the global scale, and you look at what's been happening in China, in India, look at what in Japan, they're building 6 gigawatts of new coal-fired capacity now. Same in Germany, building 7 gigawatts of new coal-fired capacity. South Korea, according to a Goldman Sachs study just the other day, they're adding 14 gigawatts of new coal-fired capacity. The U.S. has a lot of old coal-fired power plants, and this is, you know, those are polluting plants. I'm not going to argue mm-hmm. that point. But the U.S., in terms of reducing its CO2 emissions because of its abundance of natural gas, is in a very unusual position vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is turning to coal in a major way.
David Victor, step in here. Net negligible impact from this U.S. step. And the sense that even some supporters may have here that, you know, even if they think, yes, we should do this, they may still fear that globally we're on a path to a fiery future. What about it, David?
Yeah, I don't think that's correct. I think, look, this is a hard problem. It's expensive. It has distant, uncertain future benefits of less global warming. If this were an easy problem to solve, we would have made much more progress over the last 22 years of diplomacy on global warming. But there's simply no way to address the problem without international cooperation, and there is no way to make international cooperation effective without some countries leading or at least demonstrating credibility. And that's where I see this proposal as part of actually a larger set of measures that the Obama administration is putting together to try and do something about the problem. I think what's also interesting is the rest of the world is, in fact, doing all of the things that Robert Bryce was just talking about. So people are looking for gas, including shale gas. The Chinese, just in the last couple of weeks, have announced a big deal between China and Russia to bring even more natural gas into China. There are more nuclear plants under construction or built recently in China than the rest of the world combined. South Korea is building coal, but they're also building nuclear, and they're building nuclear, in fact, in other countries, Abu Dhabi right now.
But with all that, what about the steady coal appetite that Robert points to? Steady rising.
I think it's actually starting to shift now. So the last decade or so of data show this big rise in emissions, and that's a huge problem. And then when we start to look inside countries, inside India, inside China, what we see is aggressive across-the-board measures to improve efficiency of coal plants and to switch from coal to other sources. So it doesn't mean that the rise in coal is stopped, but it's actually slowing down a huge amount. And that's being done for lots of reasons, and that's going to be part of those countries' contributions to this very difficult international cooperation problem of slowing emissions.
Let's go to Coral, calling from Boston. Hi, Coral. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I hear a lot of your speakers talking about alternatives to coal that involve shale and natural gas and fracking, but why is no one talking about renewable energy? Solar seems to be taking off in the United States. For countries with limited resources, it's not something that's going to take up a lot of space or require a lot of land. I don't understand why there's a little focus on solar and wind energy. And if it's not a viable resource, then why not?
Danielle, join us here. What about the implications of this proposal for alternative energies, what it's likely to elicit on that front?
Well, we've already seen quite an increase in renewable energies. There's been a threefold increase in wind power since 2009, and I believe a tenfold increase in solar power. So we are already seeing a great increase in the number or the amount of renewable energy that's coming on board. And a rule like this is only going to support those industries further. I would add that when we go back to the international conversation for a moment, that this rule does a lot of things. It improves our climate, it improves our health, but it also, for developing countries, can show the way to how we can build a cleaner and less expensive energy model.
How does it do that if they don't have our natural gas supply, let's say, as Robert Bryce is pointing out?
Well, exactly for the reasons that the caller has pointed out, which is that it can show how you can come up with solar microgrids and storage and other types of energy usage that can help developing nations, developing villages, create a safe and healthy electricity infrastructure.
Robert Bryce, how do you see this pushing alternative energy?
Sure. To be clear, I'm bullish on solar. You look at the cost of solar coming down, and since 1980, cost of a watt of photovoltaic capacity was about $20. Today, it's less than a dollar. First Solar is saying they could have that under 50 cents in the next 4 or 5 years. It's incredibly promising. It's incredibly promising, as Danielle said, for microgrids, for rural areas. I live in Austin, Texas. I have solar panels on the roof of my house. And why did I put them on? Because the city gave me a big subsidy. What, am I stupid? Of course, I took the money. But I think what the key to remember here is the issue of scale, and that's the one that I keep coming back to. Solar is growing and rapidly on a percentage basis. But in 2012, the contribution of all global solar production was the equivalent of 400,000 barrels of oil. We're using roughly 80 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. That's 400,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day. Mm. Today, we're using 80 million barrels of oil equivalent per day in the form of coal. So yes, solar is going to see growth. Wind, I'm not a proponent of wind. It takes up too much land. I think there's a big backlash against wind because of the noise, the visual impacts, birds, etc. But I'm very bullish on solar. But we have to keep the issue of scale firmly in view.
David, I want to bring the alternative energy question to you. Let me get a call here from Houston, Texas. First, Josh, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So Western European countries get almost 60 to 80% of their power production from nuclear power and are able to do it safely. Do the new EPA rules make any room for expanding nuclear power in the U.S.?
David Victor, what about nuclear under this proposal?
Well, so one West European country in particular, France, has that high penetration, and the other countries generally have less. But there's no question that Europe has done a lot with nuclear power. The rule doesn't directly address nuclear power, but it does create incentives for states to use nuclear power as one of the different sources. As a practical matter, I think what's going to happen is that the parts of the U.S. electric power system that are highly regulated, that those regulators are going to look at a rule like this and say, it's prudent now to possibly build additional nuclear reactors. And there are several under construction right now, but the economics of them without some kind of price on carbon or incentive to reduce emissions, those economics have not been that favorable. And so we might see a little bit of new construction. Frankly, much more important will be that companies that own reactors right now that are thinking about shutting them down because they're not economic or they won't be economic if there's a need for major repair, which is what's happened here in Southern California with the San Onofre plants, those shutdowns might be avoided. And that could then keep nuclear power at, right now, it's about 19% of U.S. electric power supply. And so it's making a pretty big contribution to keeping U.S. emissions down.
Nick in Berea, Kentucky. Nick, thank you for calling. You're on.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a former fourth-generation underground coal miner, and one of the things that I've seen a lot with the coal industry back home is a lot of the destruction of the environment, as well as the health issues. So become more active in seeking alternatives to coal and other forms of fossil fuels. And one of the areas that seems to be neglected is energy efficiency. You know, we hear talk about renewables, we hear natural gas and so forth, but why aren't we seeing a larger push towards energy efficiency and culturally how we use energy in our homes, in our businesses, so on and so forth?
Yeah, Nick, it's a good question. Danielle, that is also part of the mix that's being pushed in this proposal for states. I mean, it doesn't have to be alternative. It can simply be conservation, saving energy use.
Absolutely. The least expensive kilowatt is the one that you don't use. And EPA knows that and has aggressively, not just through this rule, but through other actions as well, tried to improve energy efficiency in utilities and in homes. We are actually seeing a greater interest. Companies like Nest, bought by Google, which highlight energy efficiency actions. So it's certainly we have a ways to go, but there is a lot of promise, and energy efficiency will be an important part of this rule.
David Victor, this is serious business on many fronts, environmentally, in terms of climate, also in terms of the economy. And you expressed earlier concerns on the economic front. What kind of gamble are we taking here with the U.S. economy with this proposal? Is it we'll be fine, we'll have new jobs in other areas? If you're not mining coal, you'll be putting up, you know, conservation materials? What about the scale of this gamble, if that's what it is?
Well, I mean, again, with a caveat that we don't actually know how the details are going
to
unfold.
But that's a pretty big thing to say in itself, right?
Well, yeah, but you know, that's life.
Yeah, yeah.
We need to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
With that caveat, my read of the bill is this is not a gamble with the economy. There's
okay.
going to be complaints about costs. There are going to be some parts of the economy that are going to be harder hit than others. I think coal in particular, underground coal mining will be affected, but underground coal mining is already a tough business, as the caller indicated.
Mm-hmm.
The overall effect on the economy, though, is probably still going to be relatively small. This is a huge economy, and we have the benefit of inexpensive natural gas. Frankly, I'm happy to be living in the United States worrying about this problem and not in Europe, because in Europe, which actually has stronger emission reduction goals, the cost of energy is already roughly double what it is here in the United States and has a huge impact on European competitiveness. Firms looking to leave Europe, some of them even looking to relocate to the United States, all because the cost of energy is incredibly high. Japanese energy is incredibly high. And so this is a huge advantage for the United States economy that we need to somehow continue to preserve while also delivering on things we absolutely have to do, like cut our emissions of carbon pollution.
Robert Bryce, how about it then? This helps us negotiate with other countries, helps us prompt others to get on a cleaner path. We're, David Victor says, comparatively well set to do it. Why not?
Well, I'll absolutely agree with David Victor. The U.S. is in an incredibly enviable position now. We're we produce something on the order of 85% of all the energy we consume. The Europeans would gladly trade places with us, particularly given what's happened in Crimea.
In Russia,
we have secure supplies of natural gas. But here's my, I guess my big picture question here, Tom, or my big picture issue is, I fear with this we're simply repeating the policy mistakes of the past. In 1978, Congress passed the Power Plant and Industrial Fuel Use Act that restricted the use of natural gas for electricity generation. What happened immediately in the decade after that was a huge surge in building the very coal-fired power plants that Congress now says that they want to phase out. So that bill, that or that law, was only in, was repealed in 1987. But for me, the big picture here, and David Victor alluded to it earlier, is that we become too dependent on natural gas. I'm adamantly pro-natural gas. I'm adamantly pro-nuclear. But we're putting a lot of our eggs now in the natural gas basket. We're going to effectively restrict the any new generation capacity in the electric sector from being anything that, in terms of large quantities of new generation capacity, it's going to be natural gas. We're also seeing a surge in industrial use of natural gas in the United States for fertilizer, steel, petrochemicals. We're going to be exporting natural gas. We're using more natural gas in transportation. And I fear that, you know, we get a lot of eggs in a natural gas basket. We have a cold snap, we have pipeline disruption, something else, and then we have the price spikes that you all discussed earlier. So I just think that this is excessive intervention in the energy market by the federal government. I think if we're going to have a carbon tax, let's debate it in Congress. And instead, we've had this action bureaucratically. I understand the motivation, but I think this is, as I said at the outset, this is something the Obama administration is doing bureaucratically because they can't do it legislatively.
We see the climate challenge. We will learn the economic challenge. A lot of incentive to act here. The debate over whether, what, and how we will hear very loudly, no doubt, over the next couple of years and maybe beyond. I want to thank the three of you for helping us get on that path and see what's coming. Robert Bryce at the Center for Energy Policy, the Manhattan Institute. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
David Victor, UC San Diego. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And Danielle Bossan at the Center for American Progress. Thank you, Danielle. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're welcome. This is On Point.